This is Attack of the 20th Century. Thank you for joining us as we explore science fiction, fantasy, and horror films of the 20th century. I'm your host, Jeff.
And I'm your other host, Kim.
Welcome to episode 26, where we review John Carpenter's The Thing. Look for us on Instagram and Facebook at Attack of the 20th Century. That's 20th. We post our next movie selection there. You can comment, give your thoughts, and they just might make it on the air. So what have we been watching lately?
Well, we just went to the movies to see Death on the Nile this weekend.
Yes.
So that was great. I've been waiting for this to come out.
Right. I think we mentioned this in the first episode because Peter Ustinov was in the original.
That's right.
But we haven't seen that one yet.
No, I have intentions to watch that very soon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you've been reading this book.
I have, yeah. This is a Poirot that I have not read, and so I wanted to try and finish reading it. And when I say read, I'm listening to it on Audible, but...
we'll allow it.
Yeah, well, and it's read by David Suchet, who I love. Mm-hmm. So if anybody has watched old Poirot episodes, I'm assuming the BBC probably produced those. Because yeah. I've watched them on PBS, and that's usually where things come from. But David Suchet is like world-renowned for a lot of things, but for playing Poirot for many, many, many episodes and seasons.
Mm-hmm.
So hearing him read the Death on the Nile novel has been a great treat.
Yeah.
I've loved it.
I bet.
Yeah.
So last time you went with my mom to Kenneth Branagh's first Poirot film, which was Murder on the Orient Express.
Correct.
And this time, the whole family decided to join you girls.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of fun, I thought.
Yeah, I may have oversold what I think as quirky and hilarious Poirot characteristics to our 10-year-old. He didn't find him quite as quirky and funny as I do. He felt like we were watching a very serious movie about murder.
Yeah.
So, oops, that's my bad.
Yeah.
I thought it was great.
He wasn't a big fan, but... no, we certainly enjoyed it. You know, Russell Brand is in this film. I don't know if our listeners know who that is.
I'm sure if they're close to our age, they probably have some inkling of who Russell Brand is. We've mentioned Noel Fielding on here before because I love the British Baking Show, and he's a co-host on there now. Mm-hmm. And he and Russell Brand definitely run in the same circles.
Yeah.
So
it was odd to see him just in a completely different look than what he normally does.
Yeah.
Unrecognizable, really.
Almost unrecognizable, yes, for sure.
But no, it was a lot of fun. If you like, you know, not too serious murder mystery.
Yeah, like a classic British murder mystery. That's right. What this is. Now, is it very close to the novel? They took some liberties there, for sure.
Right.
Which I understand. They probably had to work, you know, with a smaller cast than what you can get in a novel and all that.
It's a smaller cast, but everybody's an A player pretty much in Hollywood.
The actors are dynamite, and Kenneth Branagh does an amazing job of directing it. So I love Kenneth Branagh. He can do very little wrong in my eyes. So I thought it was great. There was I had my questions. I always come away with like the dance scenes. Like I don't. That seemed very out of character for a Poirot tale, if you're used to old school Poirot. It was like they slipped in some dirty dancing scenes into this movie, which was awkward to sit next to my 10-year-old and my 16-year-old.
They were definitely getting down on the dance floor.
Oh, like legitimately rivaled the movie Dirty Dancing.
Yeah, when I say great film, like it's a good, fun time.
You know? It's definitely a fun time.
But not classic. I imagine in 5 years, I won't remember most of the movie.
Maybe not.
I'll just remember like how it made me feel. Like, oh, it's pretty good.
Right. Well, I think, you know, this is not your genre. You don't love murder mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I will hold on to it. I'll remember it because it's now part of the Agatha Christie canon, really.
Yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
It was fun.
And we'll have to go back and watch the old one and compare it, because if you're a big fan of the old one, maybe you thought this one was trash. I don't know.
Right. Your mom was with us, and she's a wealth of knowledge of all. She's watched so many of these old movies.
Uh-huh.
And she does say that the older one sticks more closely to the novel. So I'm interested to watch that one and make my own comparisons.
Cool.
Yeah. right, this is your chance to bail if you don't want spoilers and you haven't seen The Thing. But we are reviewing The Thing from 1982. It's a rated R horror monster movie set in the very, very cold landscape of Antarctica. So basically, we have a group of American research scientists. They're out on a base, I don't know, researching something in the frozen, I don't know, is it a tundra? Is it the right biosphere? Whatever it is. They're out there researching stuff in the very, very cold. And they, I think the movie opens with this weird, like there's a dog, a sled dog that looks like it's escaped, running through their base camp. A helicopter comes out of nowhere and is shooting at the dog.
Right.
So these scientists basically end up rescuing the dog, bringing it into camp. Little known to them, this dog is infected with some sort of
alien organism.
Yeah. And it becomes a shape-shifting problem in their base camp. And so basically, they spend the rest of the movie, you know, Kurt Russell and his little ragtag team of scientists trying to defend themselves against the shape-shifting alien who's out to pick them off one by one.
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm going to let you boys handle this discussion. I think you can do this without me. But I do think you'll be validated by the Rotten Tomatoes scores.
Oh, let's
hear
it.
I know this is one of your favorites. You'll be happy to know that Rotten Tomatoes agrees with you. The critics give it 82%, but the audience gives this movie a 92%.
Nice.
Yeah.
Can't wait.
There you go. All right, take it away, boys.
So, yes, I want to welcome Marcus. You may remember him from last season. He helped review Star Trek The Motion Picture. Welcome back, Marcus.
I'm back. Hope you miss me.
Yes. And then we will do Star Trek 2 this season sometime.
All right, that's good, because the first one is just like, it's okay, but it's definitely not the best one of them all.
Yeah, The Wrath of Khan is
Wrath
awesome.
Of Khan, by far, is the best one.
And then welcome back, Mike. You may remember him from the episodes where we did Invasion of the Body Snatchers and The Crow.
It's good to be back. Thank you.
Appreciate awesome. It. So one thing we do on this show, and you may have heard me and Kim talking earlier about this, but what have you been watching lately? So why don't we start with you first, Marcus? What have you been watching lately?
Oh, I just recently watched The Book of Boba Fett. But I call it The Book of Barely Fett because it was there wasn't a lot of him in it, to be honest. It was okay. I would say overall it was fairly disappointing. You know, there was two really good episodes in there. One was very heavy with Luke in it, and it was really cool how they brought him back and they used it's deepfake technology. I was going to say de-aging, but this time they used
I'd heard they got that guy for deepfake and brought him in.
Yeah. So apparently, you know, because he originally redid the scene in The Mandalorian where Luke came back, and he used the deepfake technology, and it was better. And so they actually hired him to do Luke in the future. And I thought that was a pretty good story, you know, like his work that was so good, it worked out, you know, they hired him and it shows like the portrayal of Luke in the Book of Boba Fett was by far superior to what was in The Mandalorian.
Awesome. Yeah. I haven't seen it yet. We watched The Mandalorian, of course, and loved it.
Yeah.
But we haven't watched this one, so... Is good? Is it as good as The Mandalorian, would you say?
No, I would not. I would not. Like, it was kind of disappointing because, you know, it should be about Boba Fett. And I felt like he had a very minimal role in the whole thing. I felt like Mando stole the light from Book of Boba Fett. And it should have just been... I just don't think it was very well written. I think they kind of threw it together really quickly, but... You know, is it worth a watch? Sure.
Yeah.
You know.
Did you see that one, Mike?
I actually haven't seen that one, but I am really excited about Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Obi-Wan's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was probably by far the best part of episodes 1 through 3.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
Yeah, he plays a great Obi-Wan.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Ewan McGregor is just awesome.
Ewan McGregor, yes.
And I heard a rumor they're bringing...
Hayden Christensen.
Yeah, I heard that too.
Yeah, I think that's confirmed because I think he's talked about it.
Well, they're going to start an Ahsoka series. I don't know if you know who Ahsoka Tano is. She was supposedly Anakin's Padawan in the Clone Wars. Mm-hmm. And so she's going to have her own series. And, you know, I think Hayden Christensen is going to be a lot in that one as well, right? Reprising his role as Darth Vader. So,
okay.
You know, it'll be interesting. I have hopes for that one. I have hopes for Obi-Wan, but
yeah. Hopefully they can best utilize his talents because he, I mean, you know, he wasn't just awful, but there were definitely some bad acting moments in episodes 2 and 3, I thought.
There was, but he's in the fans' minds, he's actually grown quite a bit in just their love of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's really going to be kind of interesting to see him back and going to be fun. Yeah.
So I remember when we watched, what was it, The Force Awakens, when we're watching, what's his face?
Kylo Ren.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, when Kylo Ren, when he throws his fits, hissy fits, you know, you see how awesome he is, how powerful he is, but then he has, like, temper tantrums.
Yeah.
I remember when we watched it, we said, you know, really, that's what Vader should have been, like a young teenage Vader. This was a perfect portrayal of that.
Yeah, and, it, you know, he kind of was like that in a lot of ways, but I think what they did his character wrong with was the relationship scenes. They were just so unrealistic. He had these total creepy vibes the whole time with Padme, you know?
And rolling down the hill.
Yeah, exactly. Like, just staring at her and, you know, you've grown more beautiful over the years. You know, he was just so creepy. And then... Yeah. We're supposed to believe that won her over because in real life the girls would be running, they'd be running for the hills,
they'd be creeped out,
they'd be creeped out. But somehow this won over Padme, and
I think it was him talking about the coarseness of sand,
so irritating,
it gets everywhere, So I don't know, I think. The prequels, I like the prequels, but if you take out the relationship scenes, it would be better. Or make it more believable. Like, they're struggling together, and during that process, they fall for each other. Like, they're like yin and yang. They're complimenting each other, trying to get out of problems. But instead, it was just like creepy, rapey Anakin, and that somehow won over Padme. Like, it just wasn't believable.
Right.
But yeah, I like the prequels. I like them better
than
the sequel trilogy.
Right.
I think the sequel trilogy is just really bad writing, you know?
Yeah.
Rehashes, the inferior rehashes is what I think.
I agree. It's the Kylo. The Kylo, I think, was the highlight.
Yeah.
I mean, he was really good in that.
But then it comes Jon Favreau, right? And he rescues the whole Star Wars series with the Mandalorian. I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah. It restored my hope that, they really can do something with the Star Wars franchise.
Yeah.
Well, I know they can do good things because in, what's the one after?
Rogue One.
Rogue One.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Rogue One. There's a scene with Vader comes back, you know, and he's coming down the hallway and you just hear the voice, the breathing, like, and then all of a sudden he's just like, totally goes savage on the rebels. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. Like, this is the Vader we always wanted and deserved.
Yeah.
So I know they can do great things. It's just, will they, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
We'll see. But yeah, I'm excited about the Obi-Wan series, Mike. I think that's a good call on that. I mean, Ewan McGregor is great in everything he does. And I'm just anxious to see. I guess it's that middle period because of his age. It has to be before episode 4. But after episode 3, so they must have some sort of adventures for him lined up. So what have you been watching lately, Mike?
I've not been watching a lot of sci-fi lately, except for Predator. I told you about that. I watched Predator recently, which is oddly similar in some ways to The Thing. But my wife and I, we've been watching The Morning Show on Apple Plus, which has been... Honestly, it's a pretty good show. It's kind of a take on what we're going through, like pandemic-wise and stuff like that, except for on the news. It's a pretty good show. I haven't seen it.
Like, I mean, what's it about?
It's kind of like a situation like with what happened with Matt Lauer, accused of horrible, you know, things that he's done.
Kind of the Me Too
except it's an imaginary, you know, TV station and morning show and... kind of interesting, you know, kind of looking at the recent past and and just what, you know, what we've seen and gone through and what the new station might have been going through at the same time. So
right,
we both enjoyed it. It's not great, but it's something to watch.
Fills the time.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the source material for this film first. It comes from a John W. Campbell novella. I don't know what a novella is. I guess it's a short story.
Yeah, it's a, yeah.
That's another word for short story?
Yep.
Who Goes There? From 1938, which is cool. Of course, that material got scooped up and was turned into the 1951 film, The Thing from Another World, which was directed by Howard Hawks. And I want to do this movie for this podcast.
That would be cool.
I think that would be a good one. And it's actually, you know, you watch some of these old films from the 1950s, and I don't want to get too far off on a tangent here, but a lot of these films from the 1950s are kind of cheesy, or they all just seem B-movie-ish, but it's actually a really good movie.
Yeah, I think in my one that I did with you, The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, there's a lot of good stuff in there.
Yeah, it was the same way. I would put it on the same level as Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah.
So, you know, they knew they wanted to remake this material. It went to John Carpenter, and he is a huge Howard Hawks fan. So he didn't know how this movie could be improved upon. But eventually they kept talking to him. He had been on a big winning streak. He had Halloween, which was a big commercial success. The Fog, which was a big commercial success. Escape from New York made a lot of money. So eventually they convinced him to do this thing. And so he drew parallels between the old source material, the novella, Who Goes There? And there's a story called And Then There Were None from 1939. It's a novel by Agatha Christie, which is really good. But it's the same kind of thing where one person gets picked off at a time. So they got John Carpenter on this thing, which was awesome. I think all three of us are huge John Carpenter film fans, right?
Huge.
Yeah, yes. I'd agree.
The only female presence in this film is the voice of McCready's chess computer, which was voiced by John Carpenter's then-wife, Adrienne Barbeau. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know who Adrienne Barbeau is, if you've seen Escape from New York, she is Brain's squeeze.
Got it.
And then she was also in The Swamp Thing, which we've already reviewed. So she was the main character in that. So, yeah, you know, I don't think from a diversity perspective this film could be made today because it's all males in this. But let's talk about how this movie did financially. So it was made for almost $20 million. And I'm sorry, it was made for $15 million and it only brought in $19.6 million. So it was considered a bust.
Curse you, E.T.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. So this came out the same time that E.T. came out, and everybody was like loving, friendly aliens.
Yeah.
They did not want to see aliens that were killing people. I'm going to go out on a limb here that, like, in 50 years, people are going to remember this movie more than they're going to remember E.T. What do you guys think about that?
Mm. I would definitely agree with that, because when I talk to people at work, they know about The Thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of their favorite, you know, Halloween go-to horror movies to watch every year. I don't really know anybody that's like, oh, my go-to movie in this month or part of the year is E.T.
Yeah.
It's always The Thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to actually disagree a little bit. I actually think E.T. is an awesome movie. It's amazing. The heart in it is, I mean, it's very genuine. And I think anyone that watches it as a kid has an instant connection with it. And I think, like, I mean, I know you did, you know, the Monster Squad and, you know, you haven't done the Goonies yet, but the Goonies and things like that. Everyone has this heart for these movies, right, that they watched when they were a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel like The Thing has, in terms of, like, technicals and just overall feel of the movie, it's just, it beats E.T. over.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's two different movies, right?
Yeah.
Two different movies completely, right?
You've different got one target audiences, right?
Yeah. Different target audiences. And I think it's just very unfortunate that E.T. came out right before it. It became this cultural phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had The Thing come out, which, by the way, I think Blade Runner came out at the same, like the same weekend.
Yeah.
And it also was a financial failure, right?
Yeah.
And so it's like two, like these brilliant movies that were coming out and people just wanted that feel good movie.
Yeah.
Because they'd heard so much about it. And mm-hmm. so I think all three can be in, you know, viewed as amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it didn't help that the critics were very hard on The Thing. They thought it was too gory. Oh, well,
yeah. Roger Ebert, right? Yeah. I mean, it's very hard on it.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's unfortunate. Because I, you know, we're going to get into, you know, what we really liked about this film. But I don't know of any movie that has better special effects, practical effects, than this film.
The Thing, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I completely agree. Yeah.
Even, it's amazing.
Even my my 13-year-old that mm-hmm. I was watching it with
mm-hmm.
was just commenting on how the practical effects of this movie just looks so lifelike. Yes. And he, when I told him, you know, they use things like gum and, you know, melting plastic and things like that, he's just blown away. It's just so ingenious.
I mean, you can see the problem with newer movies is they're very reliant on CGI. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the 2011 remake of The Thing, the number one complaint about it was the CGI.
Mm.
And they actually made... They brought in a lot of the original team and extras, and they made a lot of practical effects, mm-hmm. and they looked amazing. But the higher ups was like, no, people want CGI. So they actually like covered up the practical effects with CGI, and that was the number one complaint about it. Mm. It wasn't a bad movie. It wasn't, you know, the plot was good. Everything was fine.
Mm-hmm.
The actors were good. It was the CGI that literally killed the movie. And I mean, you see this in Aliens too, right? The new Aliens movies,
mm-hmm.
the original were practical effects, and they were very scary, very menacing. You know, they'll give you nightmares, as I experienced when I was younger. But the newer ones, you know, they're CGI, and they're just it's not the same. It's not as scary. So
there needs to be a good balance of practical and
like the original Jurassic Park.
Exactly.
The original Jurassic Park, they utilized practical effects with CGI, and it was perfect. And it's, you know, regarded by many as superior to the newer ones. You know, Jurassic World, where they solely rely on CGI, mm-hmm. and it just doesn't look as good as the original practical effects with the raptor heads and the mm-hmm. T-Rex head. And so...
Well, let's get into that. So I've said before on this podcast that the greatest monster movie of all time is The Thing. That's what I say. You know, when I think of all the monster movies that are out there, you know, you got Frankenstein, you have Dracula, you have Godzilla, you have all these great monsters. But for me personally, I can't think of a better monster movie than The Thing. So I don't know if you guys have any differing opinions on this. Do you? I mean,
I do actually. I mean, I think that I agree with you, but it's more than just the special effects. It's the unknown of who is actually the mm-hmm. bad guy.
Yeah.
It makes the movie just completely go, you know, amazing as far as, you know, the fear and. Mm-hmm. The unknown of who is actually the bad guy in the movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we've talked about the special effects. What I would like to do, since we're all, you know, super big fans of this film, why don't we go ahead and go into our standouts? So, of course, we have standouts and setbacks. Let's go into standouts. The first thing we've obviously mentioned are the special effects, mm-hmm. the practical effects. They were done by Rob Botten. And he had a 35-person crew of artists and technicians. And basically, you know, John Carpenter wanted to do something different. And I've heard him say this too in interviews, that typically there's an old trick that you hide your monster. Keep him in the dark. Don't let him see the monster. And it'll be more effective. But in this, he said, I have this idea. As the director, I want to bring the monster into the light so you can see it for all its grossness and goriness and awfulness. I want to bring it into the light, let's just show the user what we're dealing with. And that's what they decided to do. And oh my gosh, I mean, what horrible, nasty creatures did they create, right? You know, like, especially as humans are being turned into the thing, those horrific monsters. And they don't hide it. It's like you're seeing it, and you're seeing it drip with nastiness.
Well, I think the hidden part about it is it can emulate anything. So the dog, the human, that's where it's hidden. And so you're like, is Palmer the thing? Is MacReady the thing? Is Childs? You don't really know until it literally shows itself, and then you get surprised. So I think that's the way of hiding the monster.
Right. So our, definitely our first standout, I think I'm hearing from all three of us, are the special effects.
Yeah, the practical effects. Of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're just, they just give it that, you know, oomph, that extra thing that, you know, at, currently the CGI is just lacking.
So let's talk about some of the effects in the movies. So there's, of course, the scene where he's doing the paddles on the guy's stomach.
I can't he's remember. Doing the defibrillator.
Defibrillator, yeah. Yeah,
it's Copper. The, so Dr. Copper is doing it to... old Norris, and you know, they're basically, they're doing CPR on him, they're trying to bring him back, and out of nowhere his chest just opens up to these giant like megalodon teeth, and they just start chomping on his arms, and so on Dr. Copper's arms, right?
Yeah.
And so they actually took a guy who was amputated at the arms, and they put a mask on him to look like Copper. But people were so fixated looking at the amputated, like, squirting bloody arms that they didn't notice the face.
Had changed, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but I that always made me wonder, like, okay, he just got bit by the thing. Is he infected now?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The, what's the science of this thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But, you know, they had him tied up or whatever, setting on the thing, and I think they tested him later on, and he was negative.
Yeah.
But just, like, how does this thing really spread?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, as far as other special effects moments, what else do you guys think of?
I feel like I'm, I don't know, I'm torn between either a scene or, I would say, I'll just go with the blood scene. I mean, it's the most classic scene of pretty much any horror movie ever, right? Testing of the blood, just totally ingenious in the way that that they thought of to bring in a way of figuring out who's who. And
well, they had to improvise because they were going to take the everyone's blood and introduce it to uninfected blood, but someone or something, no pun intended, emptied all the blood from the reserves,
right?
And so he you know, when he saw after they killed Norris and his head fell off, and grew legs. And
that was a big moment in this movie, as far as special effects.
That was great, right? And he starts walking, walking, and I think it's Palmer's like, "You gotta be effing kidding me!"
amazing scene.
And they just, what a great scene.
That inspired MacReady to realize that every part of this thing is a living entity.
Yeah.
So. So he knew that if he took blood from any of the anybody and tried to kill it in some way, it was going to fight to survive.
Yeah.
And that's where introducing the heat to the blood came in.
So when they take that heat and they apply it to this, you know, whatever, what is that thing called? The little
Petri dish.
Petri dish of blood.
Yeah.
When it jumps out.
Yeah. It scares you.
What a jump scare.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was good.
Yeah. And the effects were great there, right? Yeah. I mean, how did they even do that?
And then Palmer.
Palmer, yeah. He just starts like having a seizure. Yeah. And everyone's tied up right next to him, and they can't get away. And they're just screaming.
Was that because he knew he was made?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So he was just like, okay, well, I've got to transform and get out of being tied up.
Yeah.
And so that's what he did.
So he was trying to escape at that moment. He knew that he was busted.
Yeah, I would definitely say he was trying to, like, you know, do something about the situation.
But I just,
I just thought it was hilarious. They're all tied up to him. They're like, and then the couch is just bouncing up and down. And you know, and MacReady's trying to get the flamethrower going. And of course, it's not working. And even if it was, what was he going to do? Waste everybody on the couch?
Yeah, I mean,
like, so it was just like, it was just amazing because they are literally powerless to do anything. They have this creature like geeking out right next to them. You know?
poor Windows, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, and then Windows. Yeah. He gets his head basically chomped by this thing, and then he's just getting thrown around like a rag doll.
Yeah. That scene was like devouring his body, and his legs are kicking around in the air
because he literally just has his head. Like the thing has Windows' head in its mouth, and his legs are just kicking up and down the whole time.
It's especially creepy when he's like in the corner and he's like his legs are moving slowly. They're like, you know, torch him.
And that would take me to the next like effect that I really like about this movie is the sounds. So when, you know, they throw Windows in the corner, he's like or whatever, or like when Bennings runs outside and his, you know, mangled thing hands are like, you know, 12 inches long and he's like like it's the sounds and they're just creepy. See, this movie is like, it's a mix between like a horror and a comedy.
Yeah.
Because there's so many scenes in it that are just funny. Like they're running after Bennings and they like all fall right next to Bennings and like roll. Yeah. And I'm like, this is just like a horrible place to be. You're like right next to the thing.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, horror comedy is funny because like, I think the first time you watch it, it's all horror. There's no comedy. But then when you've watched it a couple times, you're like, I don't know, you kind of laugh at it. It's like a nervous laugh, right? You're like, oh man, this big scene's coming up. Wait till, you know, we get to it.
Yeah, I mean, like going back to the Windows chomp scene, it's just kind of comical how his legs are just being flopped around up in the air. Or like how they're tied up on the couch and they're just helpless and they're just like... Just you just put your mind into the situation like, oh my God, they can't do anything about it. And this thing is like transforming right next to them.
I especially like who's the commander? I can't remember his name.
MacReady?
No, not
Jennings.
Yes, I believe so. Yeah. Where he's like, I know you gentlemen have been through a lot.
Yeah.
But if you don't mind, he starts yelling. You know,
I'd rather not spend this entire winter tied up to this effing couch.
Yeah. I will say, did you guys find it a little bit odd that Wilford Brimley escaped before his blood test? I mean, the guy's been testing his blood his whole life. He's diabetic.
Yeah.
Oh, so it's, I'm sorry. I said Jennings, but it's Gary. It's Gary.
I got Gary
and Bennings mixed up.
Yeah.
How about when the dogs all start turning? Obviously, I've never seen an alien try to take on these dogs with its long tentacles, like,
it's
grab them and pull them in. But then when they start, like, shooting the dogs and killing them so they just die. Yeah.
Well, it's
that was so gross and great.
It's like face splits open, and then the skull, like, vibrates and falls right out. And then, like, tongue tentacles come out, and they're flying around everywhere.
and just the how it was squirting the dogs with, like, enzymes. I don't even know what it was. But
purple
goo.
Purple goo.
It just, it's so gross and so just out there that,
it's perfect, isn't it?
It's perfect. It draws you in. How can you escape this thing?
Right. Yeah. And the first time you see it, or the first or second time you see it, you're like, oh gosh, that's so gross and horrifying. But as, you know, we as fans, we've seen it. I don't know how many times I've seen it, but I've seen it so many times that I'm like kind of looking forward to these scenes. And when I'm seeing them, I'm kind of like doing a nervous chuckle while it's happening.
I mean, if you've never seen it before, you know there's something wrong with the dog. Because the two Norwegians or Swedes, I can't remember what they were.
Yeah.
You know, they have a helicopter full of grenades.
Yeah.
They're shooting at this dog and you don't know why. And then they kind of like, you know, John Carpenter kind of like makes it known there's something wrong with it because it's just like, you know, there's a scene where it's kind of quiet and it's walking down the hallway really slowly.
Yeah.
And it stops at the room and you just see like the shadow of somebody look at the door.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it cuts to a different scene and you're like, okay, whatever happened, this dog did something to this person.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so you kind of like get a foreshadow of that something's going to happen. So when you actually see it happen in the dog kennel, you're like, oh, okay, that's what's wrong with this dog.
Right.
But it's like to the extreme. It's not like, oh, it's a turns into a vampire and like eats, drinks your blood. It like literally its skull falls out. It's shooting purple goo. It's shooting tentacles at everything, you know? And so to go back to the comical part about it, you know, I think it's after, shortly after that scene, the whole crew were, the lights are out and they're like, what's wrong? Mm-hmm. Who's the big burly guy? Clark. Yeah, oh, yeah. So Clark. So, you know, Clark is the one, Clark is like the one who is, you know, really kind of obsessed with the dogs. He's in charge.
He's the dog lover. Yeah.
Yeah. He's in charge of taking care of them, make sure they're fine. Well, you know, they're like, what's wrong? He's like, I don't know, but whatever it is, it's weird and pissed off.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like a great funny,
great scene.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So I think we're all in love with the effects on this one. We could have used some more of this type of effect in modern movies, right? When we think of the 20th century, like this is probably the best of practical effects.
Yeah,
definitely. Something else I wanted to mention was the music.
Oh man, yes.
So John Carpenter is famous for being kind of the one-man show, right? Because he does the directing, the, you know, music, like he's... well, he actually, I was really shocked, and I know you were too, Mike, because we talked about this.
I definitely was, yeah.
He brought in a famed composer, Ennio Morricone. And so he had done, you know, he's done over 70 award-winning films, including The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, A Fistful of Dollars. He had done The Untouchables, Mission to Mars, you know... Ripley's Game, The Hateful Eight, and you know he actually won won an Oscar, right, for a soundtrack for, I think it was The Hateful Eight. Does that sound right?
That is correct.
And which I think was more of like a lifetime achievement, really, if you look at it. Like, you know, I can't really remember the music from The Hateful Eight, but
I don't either. But I wasn't a big fan of that movie. It was not one of my favorite Quentin Tarantino movies, but.
The music doesn't really stand out. I think that Oscar was really kind of like a lifetime achievement.
Paying homage probably to the past works, like The Good, Bad, and the Ugly.
Let's talk about this, the music for a second. Talk about this, the mood that it sets. It's definitely this like bleak, because it's minimalistic kind of dread, a sense of dread it creates.
Yep.
I mean, what did you guys think? Let's start with you, Mike. What did you think about the music?
I mean, as far as the music goes, I actually was very surprised that it wasn't John Carpenter that scored this. And that was probably one of the most surprising things because I listened to the music. I guess I just never actually looked at who actually composed it. And the mood it set was just dreary. Fit with the Arctic or the not Arctic. Subarctic, Antarctic,
Antarctica, right?
Yeah, landscape that you know was there, and just basically made it very dreary and scary sounding. Yeah. Perfect,
right?
It sounds very suspenseful to me.
Yeah,
so it does sound like a typical John Carpenter score, though.
Yeah.
So what's crazy about that though is the fact that the composer won the Razzies for that music.
Oh, really?
He won the Razzies. For those of you that don't know, Razzies is basically the the anti-Oscar of awards.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really interesting about that is that the same composer, I can never pronounce his name,
Morricone.
Morricone. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Morricone composed The Hateful Eight and won the Oscar, and he actually took part of the thing's
music that was not used
in the movie
and put it into The Hateful Eight and won an Oscar.
Yeah, I noticed that. Because I recently saw The Hateful Eight and I was like, oh, this is from The Thing.
Yeah.
So it's all kind of connecting now.
So, you know, if you ever question those awards, you know, and whether they're right or wrong, I mean, they're totally wrong sometimes. They totally gooned this one because...
Well, look how many movies the critics say are bad, and then the audience overwhelmingly love it.
Yeah.
So I feel like this is kind of one of those cases.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
I will say I tried studying to The Thing soundtrack, and I got about like maybe 15 minutes in, and I was like, okay, this is creeping me out. I got to change it to something else. Yeah. And then I was creeped out for like 2 days straight after that. And I was like, I'm never going to try to study to The Thing soundtrack again.
Yeah. One of the things that I loved about The Thing sequel, which is really the prequel, was when it transitions at the end.
Yes.
To the new movie, you know, to the 1982's The Thing.
Yes.
They use that same music and they have that. Bum, 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 bum. Bum, bum. I just love that transition. And it was the music that took you there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like the music is what really took you from the prequel to the
bridged
sequel.
Bridged it together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the prequel had two things right. The music and the set design, right? Mm-hmm. They did a good job with trying to emulate what they saw at the camp, at the Norwegian camp. Yeah.
He calls them the crazy Swedes, but they're Norwegian.
Yeah, the crazy Swedes.
Okay. That's why I got to mix them. Like, I don't know if they're Norwegian or Swedish. I mean,
And the leading actress in that film was really good too. I thought she was too.
It's just a shame they did not.
They covered up the practical effects with CGI. So if there's any executives listening to this podcast, do not cover up the practical effects with CGI.
Yeah.
Combination.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't make organic material CGI. We've talked about
before. Yes. It's, you know,
it's too, better for
it's not well landscapes. Developed. It's not developed enough right now to completely replace.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of landscapes, actually, I thought the painter did a really good job in this movie.
Yeah. No, that's a good point.
Yeah. So we talk about the practical effects of, you know, the monsters and everything, but actually there were several landscape scenes where it was a painter that had done it. Mm-hmm. I think there was one of Earth, and it was just, you can't even tell for the most part. I mean, if you really concentrate,
like in the beginning when the UFO is like crashing down.
Exactly. In the beginning, you've got that halo around the Earth, of the atmosphere. And then, there's a scene where they are lowering themselves down into the pit where the spacecraft is. Just really good job there.
Oh yeah. So talking about that scene, I always have this question. Is the Thing the one who made the UFO and is controlling the UFO? Or is it like a different alien species that's being taken over by the Thing and that's why it's acting erratic and crashes?
Oh, that's a good question.
Oh wow. Oh.
That may not be their spaceship, basically.
Yeah, I think my personal belief is it's an alien species being taken over by a Thing. And that's why it's acting erratic and crashes.
Oh, that would make a lot of sense then.
Like, I'm blown away. That's actually a great idea.
That may not be their spaceship. There might somebody be somebody else they've invaded.
Yeah, maybe they can make a prequel, like, here's the aliens having to deal with the Thing.
Oh, that's great. And then it crashes. That's a great idea.
And then it bridges into the new one.
That's great.
That gets re-released with the practical effects.
So other standouts. Do you have any, Mike, that you would like to call out?
I mean, I think that John Carpenter was genius in having these guys live together. And we were just talking about it. I didn't look it up.
Maybe a couple weeks or something.
A couple weeks living together in the cold conditions to kind of give a more camaraderie amongst the men that were filming the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it really did wonders with just the feeling that you got with the movie. It felt like these guys had been together for a long time.
Yeah.
Well, they're confined. It's almost like a prison. Yep. They can't get away from the Thing.
Yeah.
If they try to get away, they're going to freeze to death. Right. So they're stuck there having to deal with it.
Yeah.
So
it really was a death sentence when the thing took out all their power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They knew then they were dead.
Yeah.
Because they have no helicopter anymore. They have no way escaping. They can't get warm. It was a death sentence.
That's why they decided to blow it up.
Yeah.
He's like, we're not going to make it out of this, so let's blow it up and try to stop it.
Yeah. Mm. So a standout author out there is Kurt Russell. We've talked about Kurt Russell in the past. He's one of the most underrated actors that I can think of.
Completely.
Agreed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say he's probably my favorite actor.
Yeah. He does great in this. Like, and you think of, I can't think of too many awesome lines that he delivers. This is where the acting comes in, where he's responding to events that are happening. And they just show his face, like just, you know, responding to whatever's happening.
Yeah. I mean, I think he fits the role perfectly in this movie. And it just, it, you know, to give Kurt Russell credit is, you know, he was an overboard.
Mm-hmm.
It was completely different
yeah.
from the character he plays in the thing.
Yeah.
I mean, there's Snake Plissken,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's Captain Ron, you know, and now he played Santa Claus. I think it was the Christmas Chronicles. So he's just such a diverse actor and can play many different roles. And not only can he do them, but he does them very well.
Yeah, I would throw Death Proof in there. If I don't know if you guys have seen Death Proof.
Mm-mm.
Amazing acting from Kurt Russell. Just amazing.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we're going to watch Stargate later tonight.
Oh, yeah. It was Stargate. Exactly. Yeah.
Hey, another one that nobody remembers is Backdraft.
Oh yeah. Backdraft.
He's really good in that.
Yeah,
very good.
Yeah, he's very good.
Yeah.
I would say all the actors did really well. They definitely like portray the horror, the fear, the mistrust of each other when the thing is kind of like they know it can emulate anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I would just say all the actors should be, you know, praised.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
I would say another standout for me is just how John Carpenter keeps you on your toes. You truly really never know who the thing is.
Mm-hmm.
And so it almost puts you into the setting like the characters. They're mistrustful of everyone else because they don't know who the thing is. And you are feeling those same feelings. There's parts where Dr. Copper is acting really suspicious that when they have the blood banks. And he's like, you know, they're trying to decide who has the keys. And it's like, Copper has it, and so does Gary. And he's like, oh, I don't know. I always have my keys on me. What about Gary? And he looks at Gary, and it just and it just always seemed like, oh, okay, he's trying to convince everybody he's not the thing, but it's Gary, but he really is.
Yeah.
But it later on, it ends up he's not the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he does a very good job of like putting you as one of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can't really trust anybody and you're constantly guessing who the thing is.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, I actually watched a YouTube video about who Patient Zero is.
Oh, right? Okay.
Like who was the original person that got infected and then infected the rest of the crew. And it was so interesting because, like, they pointed out that John Carpenter, when he did The Shadow on the Wall, which we assume is the very first person that's been infected.
To me, it looked like Norris, but I don't know exactly.
The one who got licked by the dog? Or, no, that's not Norris.
Oh, the guy who was under the table that got, like, he's, like, pinched by the dog or bit by the dog. Well, there's that,
and then the dog in the first scene ran up to... I'm just blanking on his name. Clark. Yes.
But he wasn't the thing because they blood tested him.
Exactly.
Later on.
Exactly. So, but who was the shadow on the wall, right?
Yeah.
Because that's the official scene where it's like, okay, we know something happened here because
it was Norris. But then later on, there's scenes where Norris, he's like, he's still, you know, he's still human, but his stomach is hurting. He's like, you know, like he's like grimacing with pain.
Yeah.
And so it's like he's transforming.
From the inside.
Yeah, from the inside. So whatever happened, like the dog bit him maybe or infected him somehow or licked him. I don't know, but
well, maybe. Yeah. But the thing I was listening to, the YouTube video, I can encourage anybody to look it up just so they know what I'm talking about, is was that the thing is so good at emulating your body that it emulates even the deficiencies that you have, such as that maybe it was such a stressful event that he literally, the thing, was having a heart attack at that moment.
Oh, yeah. It wasn't a ruse, basically.
It wasn't a ruse. It was, yeah, because, I mean, he was alone, right?
Yeah.
Why would it be a ruse?
Right.
Know? He could just pretend like he was having a heart attack. But So.
Yeah. You know, and that's the crazy thing about the thing. When it takes you over, it's got your same pitch of your voice.
Yeah.
You know, like the same memories, it seems. Brain chemistry, right?
Yeah. I'm always wondering, when did Palmer become affected? The guy tied up on the couch.
Oh yeah,
you know,
you got to watch that YouTube video. It's awesome.
Yeah. Okay, I'll check it out.
Yeah, it even drops. It even goes into the dropped keys, and in that scene where, remember the body of the thing that they had brought in from the Norwegian site, right? You see it dripping, and then it takes over
Bennings,
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Well. Windows drops the keys in that scene.
Okay.
And so, but then we see the keys later. And so it's really kind of interesting, you know, who is the one who infected everyone?
Yeah.
And that shadow that's on the wall is actually just a stagehand. It's not a specific actor because John Carpenter didn't want anyone to believe it was one particular actor.
It kind of had like the similar perm.
He did, as
Norris,
yes.
So yeah. That's why I was like, oh, it looks like Norris.
Yeah.
I think he's...
So let's talk about the very end real quick before we get to setbacks. So MacReady, I think, was framed, right, by the thing. The thing framed MacReady by tearing up his coat, remember? Yeah. And they locked him on the outside and all that.
Which shows it's intelligent.
Yeah, it's very intelligent. So at the end, I'm very much, you know, the mindset that MacReady is a human.
Yeah.
He hasn't been turned.
And I think Childs is...
What maybe about Childs? Because Childs disappeared for a long freaking time.
He did. I mean...
Do you guys have a theory on that? Is Childs at the end? Is he turned?
I do a little bit.
Well, go ahead.
Okay. He does disappear. That's true. But in the very end, he shares the bottle of whiskey or whatever it is, bourbon, with MacReady. And they were on like a strict... don't share food policy together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe he thought I'm dead anyways, screw it.
Yeah.
So you don't really know, but he takes a drink of the whiskey and MacReady looks at him and like kind of chuckles a little bit because at that moment he kind of knows that MacReady's it. I mean, Childs is it.
Mm.
MacReady knows that Childs is the thing.
Well,
but you don't really know.
That's a good way to look at it. Yeah.
I think if he really thought he was the thing, though, he would try to kill him.
But well, maybe he was after. Maybe he was just taking it slow.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't see that scene.
But that's true, too. But the other thing is, okay, so just in argument of that, why wouldn't Childs just
like
do his thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
it's
take
just
him over.
The two of them, right?
Because I think at that point, he knows if he tries to take on MacReady, he might lose, or he or she, whatever the thing is, might lose.
Yeah.
And so it's best to just freeze and then be rescued by another team.
Yeah. MacReady will be dead because he can't just thaw. But then, you know, he'll get, hopefully,
they'll get rescued.
Rescued in the future. That makes sense.
But... that's just theories. We don't know for sure. And that's what makes this movie so good.
Yeah.
Is the mystery. And I think a lot of problems with movies today is they have to spell everything out to the audience.
Yeah.
And in the past, it's like, okay, we're going to leave this mystery. We're not going to explain what happened to the Jedi. We're not going to explain what happened to, you know, whatever, A, B, and C. We're just going to kind of leave it up to interpretation. And you can kind of like make your own, you know, thoughts and have your own imagination about it.
So on that note, any executives listening.
Yes.
You know, we're talking to them earlier. My 13-year-old, I was talking to him about the movie and asking him what his thoughts were. His favorite things were, of course, the practical effects. He thought it looked awesome, and the fact that they used gum and stuff like that. But his other favorite thing was the end scene where it was left open, because it makes you think.
Yeah.
A 13-year-old said that.
Yeah.
We don't have to have...
It's the same with the aliens. Like, is the aliens the thing, or is the aliens being taken over by the thing? Like, how did they get there? Like, why is it crashing? You just don't know, and it doesn't really need an explanation.
Yeah.
We don't need to know how Han Solo gets his name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
You know, it's like, it's just a mystery, an interpretation, and it should be kind of left at that.
Right.
Agreed.
Well, let's talk about setbacks. So, Mike, I know you had mentioned a setback when we talked the other night about it.
Yeah. So, the only thing, and I love this movie, like, love it, but the only thing I would say that I kind of thought was a little weird or funny is we're dealing with a 1970s helicopter and Wilford Brimley. What's his name again?
Blair.
Yes. Blair. He's stealing parts from this helicopter to create a spaceship.
Yeah.
And so that's the only thing that kind of made me go, can you really make a spaceship out of helicopter parts? I mean, unless maybe there's some magic that we just don't know about, but
right.
But you know, you can't really do that with movies. The only thing is, and I think maybe you brought this up, Jeff, is that maybe his plan was to get the shell done or something like that, and then eventually make it back to the spaceship at the Norwegian camp.
Yeah.
And there's something there that would make it, you know.
Right. Maybe he's just getting done what he could get done. He's killing time.
Maybe.
What about you, Marcus? Any setbacks you want to bring up?
No, I don't really have any complaints about this movie. I would say just the one weird thing that got to me was that they said that the UFO was buried under 100,000 years worth of ice. And I understand that, you know, the UFO crashes and maybe it penetrates with some depth. But the thing that they dug out was like maybe 4 feet under the ice. And I just don't see how that equates to being 100,000 years. Like, did the thing, you know, get out at some earlier, like later date, and then get on top somehow.
Right.
You know, like maybe a volcano was releasing hot gas and warmed it up and it crawled out and then refroze. I don't know. But,
yeah,
you know, the ship is clearly like way deeper than the thing.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Cause it was, I remember that scene. Like, that's where the painting came in, where they're lowering themselves down. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It was, had to been 10 stories. I mean, it was... Yeah.
They may have done a throwaway line about he got thrown from the ship or something like that, but there's no way. I mean, there's just no way that would have happened.
Well, I mean, even if it got thrown out, how does that equate to 100,000 years worth of ice? It's really not that deep. I mean, it maybe at most was maybe 4 feet deep.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's probably like maybe 10,000 years.
Right. That's true.
I would say the other setback is it's so short. I like it. I like it so much. I wanted more.
Want more?
But that might be a good thing. Maybe I'm asking for something that I don't realize would actually be a bad thing. Like, the mystery behind it is great. But at the same time, you're like, oh, I want to know. But you just can't. But, yeah.
Well, you wonder how long your brain wants to be in suspense.
Yeah.
And there's a huge feeling of suspense throughout this whole film. And so, what if it lasted 3 hours, 3.5 hours? Can you physically be in suspense for 3.5 hours? I mean, physically, at some point, you might start checking out.
Maybe. Yeah. I have hope, though.
Maybe. Since the movie's already been, I wouldn't say tarnished, but it's been, you know, it's got a prequel, right? So it's not like it's encapsulated in this one single film that's amazing now. I'd like to see a sequel of the thing actually getting out into the world, exactly what Wilfred Brimley was worried about.
Right.
I want to see that. I want to see that happen. So I think that'd be fun.
Yeah.
I'm talking to the executives again.
Yeah. Executives. Let's see a sequel. You know, what would you think about like a mini series? Cause maybe, you know, an hour and a half's not long enough.
Oh yeah.
I mean, you could have a whole season of, you know, this thing getting out. You know, maybe there's some sort of rescue mission that happens and they see all these dead bodies and I don't know. They take these guys back to the lab, they thaw, and then boom, you know, he starts killing medical professionals and it starts going on from there. But
I think what made the original great was how confined they were. Like they're stuck. And so I hear what you're saying, but I think if it's an open world thing, it's like, well, then it's just, it could go and radiate as fast as possible. And like, how would you truly stop that?
Yeah.
You know, the inevitable is it's taking over.
Right.
And so I think if you did do a sequel, it would have to be, it's somehow confined or has limitations in some form or fashion.
Right.
You know, so you know, okay, there's a chance this thing could be stopped, but is it? You know,
that's true. If they went right to New York City, for instance, you're like, oh no,
you're screwed, right? You're screwed, like it's going around.
Well, maybe you could flip it on its head and have the human be the alien. Hey. I don't know, something like that. Where you know,
well, that's a good idea too. Like, what is the home base for this thing? You know, what's its home planet?
Yeah.
What do they do?
Yeah,
you know what I mean? When they're not intercepting other, life forms and taking over their bodies, what are they doing?
Well, it might have started off very primitive and encounters more advanced species. And it's kind of like the Borg. I don't know if anybody's a Star Trek fan, but the Borg simulates new technologies. And, you know, the more it simulates, the more technologies it takes in. And so essentially the thing is the Borg, right? And so it could start off very primitive, but as it starts building up, encounters new species and new civilizations, it gets more and more intelligent. Hmm. And so you have, you know, the scene with Blair where he somehow is able to create like a mini UFO with helicopter parts.
Yeah.
Because he's literally got so much intelligence now collected from who knows how many different species. We know at least maybe one other than humans, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, that's just a possibility.
Right. Well, let's get into final summations. Usually, it's a mystery, yay or nay. I think we've all established that this is a yay for us. Why don't we go around, maybe give your final summations to the film? Like, would you recommend it? So why don't we start with you, Marcus? Would you recommend this film?
I mean, obviously, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm wearing a Thing t-shirt right now.
Yeah. Yeah,
I am not wearing a Thing t-shirt. I'm wearing a Bob Marley t-shirt. I missed the memo, but I would say 100% I would show this to anyone that hasn't seen it. I'd watch it 100 times. I never get old. It never gets old.
No.
And I especially loved reliving this movie with my kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's rated R, but I mean, it's rated R mostly for the violence.
By today's standards, it's more PG-13.
Exactly. Yeah. It's, it was fun. It was super fun watching it with them.
My only advice would be don't ruin it. Don't tell anybody what's going to happen. Don't let them go and read the plot. Just let it be raw in raw form and watch it.
Yeah. Just hit play and sit back.
Yep.
You may want to just watch their face during the blood scene, the blood testing scene, right?
Yeah. Obviously, it's a yay for me. I've called it the greatest monster movie of all time. So, yeah, we watched it with our kids, too, and it was the same thing. During the whole gore scene, they were just grossed out as can be. And I'm like, I'm over there, like, laughing and cackling, and they're like, oh, gross!
Yeah. You're like fist pumping, and you're like, yeah! Like, living vicariously through your children. I would say there is... there's a lot of irony in the movie and, you know, a lot of like underlying humor as we talked about before. And, there's the scene where they go out to Blair in the tool shed And he's like, I swear, I'm so much better. I feel a lot better. Just let me out of here. And yeah. meanwhile, there's a noose hanging right by his head as he's saying this. Yeah. And you're just like, okay, this is so funny. Yeah, you're definitely a lot better. There's a noose hanging right by your head. And, you know, yeah. MacReady's reaction is appropriate. He just shuts the little yeah. viewing port. He just shuts the little door. And he's like, nope. And goes back.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. So the scene... the first time he talks to him out there, he warns him, watch Clark.
Yeah.
Just watch Clark. Because he was around those dogs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think he was human at that point.
I do. I agree. And I don't remember if they tested him or not, but at some point the thing got to him.
Obviously, but, yeah. By the end of the movie, yeah.
But I believe he was human at that point as well.
On the video that I had been watching, they talked about the fact that this happened over a couple of days, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. maybe it was someone that was coming to feed him or something like that.
Yeah, they could have poisoned his food somehow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Of course, he could have been, when he was saying that, he could have been throwing them off from him, right?
That's true, because Clark actually wasn't the thing.
Exactly.
Well, I think one thing that, and they do this in every horror movie, right? Like, they're all established or not the thing. So what do? They split up. And it's like, what? At that point, you know none of you are the thing. So, like, just stay together.
Stay together.
But they leave Chiles. Like, why did they leave Chiles? It didn't make any sense to me. They left them. They're like, we're going to go out to Norris. You stay here. Why? Why are you staying there? Just go with him.
Yeah, let's all just see be Blair. Together all the time.
Yeah, but they left him there, right? But, you know, and obviously it wouldn't be a movie if they were smart about it. But so they go out to the tool shed and he's not there. And then all of a sudden they see Chiles run out. Mm-hmm. And then later on, you know, MacReady's like, where did you go? And Chiles like, I thought I saw Blair, so I ran up after him, you know?
Yeah.
But we wouldn't really have a good, you know, mystery horror movie if you didn't have, like, just bad decisions in general, that's right? That's
true. There's actually a video game that was made as a sequel to that, and there's also comic books that were made.
I know there's a video game. I've never played it, but it's probably too scary, to be honest.
It got pretty good reviews from what I was reading, so.
I mean, I played Aliens vs. Predator as a kid, and that's... was one of the scariest games I ever played. So I can imagine the thing would be just right there with it.
On that same vein of thought, I don't know if you guys ever, I think you did actually go to Universal Studios Halloween Horror Nights.
Yeah, Marcus did.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so I went to the Aliens vs. Predator one. And see, okay, so a little backstory about me is when I was young, like I don't remember how old I was, 8 or 9, my family took me to see Aliens 3, which ultimately scarred me for the rest of my life.
That may have been my fault, by the way, because I talked our dad into taking us to see Aliens 3.
Oh my gosh, I was scared of the xenomorphs probably up until like high school. And so here I am like a senior in high school wondering when this xenomorph is going to come crashing down and eat my face with its little chomper. You know, bust into my skull and chomp my brain with it. But, you know, but yeah, they had it at Halloween Horror Nights and it was amazing. I loved it. But I like the xenomorphs. I love Aliens now. I love Aliens. I love watching it.
Yeah.
It's a great movie. You know, I definitely don't lay in bed at night wondering if I'm going to have a xenomorph attack me anymore. But the house at Halloween Horror Nights, the xenomorphs still give me a little eebie-jeebies. They still do. And another one is the Great Movie Ride. So the Great Movie Ride, there's a scene with like Ripley with the blowtorch and the alien comes crashing down.
Yeah, I remember that one.
That's the best part of the whole ride.
So what about the year the Thing prequel came out? You and I went together to Halloween Horror Nights in Orlando, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And they were playing the movie. They were playing clips of the movie. And they had the thing, like the haunted house type thing, right? Mm-hmm. Do you remember that?
I honestly don't remember that. I don't know why.
Oh, I remember.
Tell us about it, Mike.
So when you walked in, it was like you were on the movie set. It was freezing in the room. Like they had it. I don't even know how cold it was. But you felt really cold.
Uh-huh.
And you're walking in and it felt like you're on the set. You know, you see the the buildings in Antarctica, and you go in, and it was so cool. I mean, mm-hmm. they did such a good job on this Halloween Horror Nights. Mm-hmm. They even had the girl who looked very similar to the actress. Mm-hmm. There was one scene I remember in particular where she was like up against the wall, just breathing heavily, you know, with a gun pointed up, like looking past the wall. It was just like so good.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah.
I think we're all craving more The Thing.
We need more of The Thing. Yeah.
We do.
Yeah. Hollywood, bring it to us.
Done right, though.
Done right.
Yeah. Yes. Practical effects, mostly practical effects. You can throw a little CGI in there, but stay true to the original.
All right, this episode has been a lot of fun to do. The Thing is one of my favorite films of all time. So, guys, I just thank you both so much for coming today and doing this podcast with me.
So fun. Thanks, Jeff. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. I'm actually like looking at you, wondering if you're The Thing now.
Oh, man. Now you got me thinking.
You'll not know until later.
Or we'll just never know, and that's what the mystery part about it.
And this is the last of these shows, so...
All right, so what are we watching next week?
Okay, next week, we are still in 1982, and we will be watching Poltergeist.
Oh,
which you assure me is not as terrifying as I've thought it was my whole life.
No, you won't be too scared.
So basically, a family's home is haunted by a host of demonic ghosts. Mm-hmm. It is rated PG, and you're telling me it's Spielberg horror, so I'm not going to be... just scared out of my gourd
for a week.
Have to sleep with all the lights on.
I don't think so. I think you'll... I've only seen it once, and I was able to sleep that night. So that's a good indicator.
All right.
So yeah, check out that film this week. Watch it. It is free right now on Tubi TV.
Well, there you go. You can watch it for free, and we can all be scared together.
Oh, I can't wait. So, that does it for us this week. Want to thank Mike and Marcus for joining us as we reviewed The Thing. That was a lot of fun.
Thanks, guys. We appreciate it.
And we will talk to you again next week. Have a good one.
Enjoy your movie watching, guys. Peace out.
Peace out.